This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson at WDET in Detroit. I'm in the studio with the show's producer, Carrie Jr. II. So today we're going to talk about a pretty serious subject, and that's the lives of children who find themselves, for whatever reason, as part of the foster care system in our country. Today we're going to talk to somebody who has an incredible perspective on this. Andrew Bridge is a children's rights lawyer, but he's also a survivor of the American foster care system. And so when he is advocating for kids, when he is trying to change the system to be better for them and their families, he's doing it from a place of real knowledge and understanding.
Right. Like you said, he's a child's rights lawyer. His original book he wrote that came out in around 2008 was called Hope's Boy. Hope is his mother. And he talks about her experience, who she was and how she was a mother to him, and how some of her situations and her circumstances led to him being put in that care system. Her circumstances and his father's circumstances, mm-hmm. I should say. Mm-hmm. He spent 11 years in the foster care system. And then after that, he went and graduated from Harvard Law. He went on to be a Fulbright scholar, and he went on to, as we said, advocate as a lawyer for these kids. So
his story turns out really well.
Right.
And despite that, he still talks about how painful it was, mm-hmm. and how it didn't serve him,
right.
and didn't serve his family. And that's what motivates him now.
Mm-hmm. And specifically how he feels as if the incentives
in the system
for the system, yeah. are in conflict with the betterment of the child.
The best interest of the
child.
And of
yeah.
families.
And of families, yeah. in his view.
Yeah, so. Yeah. You know, just to set the stage for this conversation, there are about 400,000 children, mm-hmm. in the United States who live in foster care. Mm. I mean, think about how many that is. Think about how many families that's disrupting,
right.
or were disrupted and had to resort to the foster care system. It's something that touches so many people and, mm-hmm. and every community in our country, especially here in places like Detroit. Mm-hmm. We know, for instance, that in predominantly African-American communities, mm-hmm. The foster care system has custody of more children than it does in others. Mm. So this is a critical issue about opportunity, how it unfolds, and how it affects children and their families. So I want to start here with some just kind of stark facts to start our conversation. So you spent 11 years in the foster care system, but you're also a Fulbright scholar and a graduate of Harvard Law, and you had a mother who was diagnosed as schizophrenic. That is a very broad spectrum of experience, and I think it speaks directly to some of the things that you write and speak about. But let's start there. Tell us about your family. Tell us about your parents, and tell us how you ended up in the foster care system.
Well, I'm the son of what was a single mom. My father, he left my mom very shortly after they had me. My mom didn't go to college. She didn't graduate from high school. She went to beauty school. And as most single moms, she struggled. And so, she planned out our future with me at her side. I watched her descend into schizophrenia when I was 6 years old. Mm. So our life went from what was a really pretty stable environment of an apartment and a bedroom to a motel in North Hollywood where we were venturing out at night hunting for food from dumpsters. And one day in the early morning, a squad car rolled up alongside me, asked me if my name was Andrew, and literally pulled me from my mom's arms and put me in a place called McLaren Hall, which was in Los Angeles County. It was an abandoned polio hospital with about 300 kids in it. Mm. I stayed in foster care for the rest of my childhood. I was never adopted, never returned to mom. And so what happened to me is what we really don't want to ever have happen to a kid, and what I work for as an adult not to happen to children, is that when we take kids from their families, not return them back, not have them be adopted, and essentially have them raised by the state.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go back to that moment when a squad car pulls up and rolls down the window and asks you if your name is Andrew, and you say yes, and they take you from your mother. I mean, the range of emotions, I think, in that moment, and the fear that you must have felt. Talk to us about what was going through your mind at that moment.
Well, you know, I have to say, I think it was probably the most frightening moment of my life, one that happened the week before my 7th birthday. And it's why, you know, my second book is called The Child Catcher. Mm-hmm. That's what it felt like. Mm-hmm. It felt like a kidnapping. No one explained who they were. No one explained where my mom was going to be. No one explained how she would know to find me. No one explained how I would find her. No one explained the system that I was in. So I was put into a social worker's car, and within an hour and a half, everything that I knew about my life, from the clothes that I was wearing to where I was going to school or had been going to school, to most importantly, my mom, were gone. Mm-hmm. and did not come back.
And the effort here made by the system, I mean, for lack of a better word, was supposed to save you, correct? I mean, in their eyes, they were helping you. They were taking you from what they saw as a dangerous situation and supposedly sending you to something better. Do you feel like that's what happened?
That's all correct. My mom, I just want to be clear, my mom never hurt me. My mom was suffering terribly, but she never hurt me. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. From that day that I was taken by Los Angeles County into care, all that any social worker, judge, or lawyer had to ask that little boy was, Andy, do you have family? Mm. And if they had asked that, I would have said that I had a grandmother, a great uncle, a great aunt, an uncle, and three cousins on my mom's side. And there were more on my dad's side.
Yeah.
Had someone asked that question, I would have gone home and not spent the next 11 years in foster care.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the greatest failing of foster care for me, and the failing that a lot of children face today.
Yeah.
Not being returned to their families.
Well, and I think that's really the point of a lot of your work, is that this is the way, again, the system tends to work. It tends to attempt to rescue children from situations that are deemed inappropriate or dangerous, but it doesn't take into account what's possible, you know, within the reach of that child's own family or environment. That it breaks an important tie with who you are and where you're from.
That's exactly right. And I think it's very important for folks to understand, for people to understand, that the vast majority of kids who enter foster care, somewhere around 60 to 70%, they don't enter care because they've been abused. Mm-hmm. They don't enter care because they've been physically hurt. They enter care because their parents and family are poor. Mm-hmm. And with that in mind, we need to look at this system and say, is this the best way to deal with and respond to the needs of families because they're poor? Should we be taking children away from families because they have a home that isn't the cleanest, because they have to leave a child alone in order to work, because they confront all of those things that wealthier families don't confront and don't really have to think about? Mm-hmm. That's the thing that we need to look at. And I think at its core, what it comes down to is respecting these families and understanding their value and their worth.
So if that had happened in your case, the way that you just described, respecting the value and worth of your family, what would have been a reasonable alternative? Or do you think that you didn't really need an alternative to living with your mom? Were they wrong about how they assessed what was happening to you?
Well, I'd say, first of all, what would have happened is I would have been sent to live with my grandmother. My grandmother lived in Chicago. I'd actually lived with my grandmother for a little while. My grandmother knew me. She loved me. She cared about me. and I could have gone to live with her. And the thing that would have happened is once I lived with my grandmother would have been able to assess how her daughter should interact with me, mm-hmm. when her daughter was doing well, when her daughter wasn't, what her daughter needed, and what would make that relationship between her grandchild and her daughter one that still had love in it, one that still had a connection. That would have made the difference.
Yeah. And was the system wrong about your mom? I mean, you talked about her struggles with mental health. Yeah. Was she unable to care for you? Was she permanently unable to care for you? Were they right in the way they assessed this?
So what I get asked that question, and I think the first thing is to just what does care for mean? Hmm. Could my mom have held her own apartment, got me ready for school, seen to that I was fed, got me home from school all on her own? No, she couldn't have done that. But there's another part of caring. There's a part called love. Hmm. Did my mom love me? Yes. So did that mean that she needed to be barred from my life? That she needed to only have 15-minute phone calls that were monitored once a week or 1 hour a visit monthly? Hmm. No. My mom could have been allowed in my life so much more. And I think that's the thing, and the work that I do in child welfare today is to understand that parents have so many things to offer and to wrap our heads around the idea that failures and love can, in fact, exist side by side.
Yeah.
And there are very few parents who have absolutely nothing to offer their children. Parents love their children and their children love them. Ask a foster child today, where do you want to go? What do you want to have happen? And inevitably, the first thing they will say is, I want to go home. Mm. I want to go back to mom. I want to go back to dad.
Well, and if you think about it, I mean, any of us who are parents will admit to the complication of the definition of that word and that experience, right? There are things that as a parent you do that you're like, man, I am nailing that. I am putting it over the fence in that way. But then there are other things that you're like, oh my goodness, I'm really not getting this right. And I can't get this right. I can't figure this part out. But the reality is about the struggle, right? It is about the tension between those two things and your constant effort to try to do more of one than the other. There's nobody who is 100% on one side or the other of it.
I think that's so true. And I think that's what foster care struggles with, is to recognize that parents are struggling. And parents may never get some parts of it right. But the point is there's love between that child. There's an attachment. And above all, we want to keep that attachment there. We want to keep it intact. We don't want it suddenly to go missing, that suddenly a child feels that they're orphaned, feels that they're lost in a system that doesn't really care about them. And I will say that children know that a system doesn't care about their mother or their father or their families. Mm. And when a child knows that, the first thing they think is, if you don't care about the people that are most important to me, how am I to believe that you actually care about what happens to me?
Wow.
That's the thing.
Yeah. So you were talking about the system being designed to kind of react this way to situations in which it intervenes and that in general, it reacts this way. Let's talk about a little about why this is a common experience, and why hasn't the system figured out a better way to quote unquote help people who are in the situation?
You know, that's a complicated question. I think there are lots of ways to answer. Some folks would answer that it's money. The way foster care departments are paid, they're paid on the basis of the number of kids they take and how long they keep them. That's a terrible set of incentives. Mm-hmm. But there's something deeper, and there's something I remember as a kid and something I know when I talk to kids who I've represented and helped in the foster care system. And that is a failure to fundamentally respect the families that they came from. You know, overwhelmingly, foster care departments call them the Department of Children and Family Services. It's that service to family part that's missing. Hmm. That willingness to sit down with a mom and say, you're having trouble finding a job. Let's help you get there. You're having trouble finding an apartment. Let's help you get there. And, you know, I serve on the Arizona Foster Care Review Board, and the number of times that I see mom will find a job, mom will find an apartment. And what she's given is a list that goes on, and there are backlogs on it. And all the while, the timeline for terminating her rights keeps ticking away. And so we end up, and often in this system, are things called children, called legal orphans. Mm-hmm. And that's when we've terminated parental rights. They don't have an adoptive family. They don't have a guardian. They're not going back home. They literally have no one.
And what happens then? I mean, what's the end of that story?
So the end of that is reaching 18 and aging out. Mm-hmm. The end of that is entering the world as an 18-year-old, which I think everyone knows, everyone that has ever parented a child, that is not grown up.
No.
May look grown up on the outside, definitely not on the inside. And what happens is that 18-year-old enters the world alone and is expected to find a job, expected to make it through college and school, expected to find a place to live on their own. And they've not been given the things that allow them to do that. And they don't have the sports that other kids have. You know, an 18-year-old who leaves a very nice family, leaves a family where they've grown up in. You know, if they stumble, mm-hmm. if they don't stay at their job, maybe they fall out of school, whatever they do, that family's there for them. That family will help them. And the thing that's lacking in foster children's lives is they don't have that. They don't have that hand that reaches out and says, "When you stumble, I will catch you."
And it's not if, it's when, right?
It's when.
I mean, all of us have some moments where we can't get it right. We can't figure it out.
We know this as parents. We also know this as just human beings. There are times we just don't get it right. And the number of times that we've gone ahead and we've relied on someone, we've had someone there, someone we could call, someone to help us out. And that's what's missing.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Andrew Bridge about our foster care system here in America. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We're back with Created Equal. I'm Stephen Henderson, and my guest is Andrew Bridge. He's a children's rights lawyer and a survivor of the American foster care system. We're talking about the foster care system and some of its shortcomings. So, Andrew, at the end of the last segment, you were talking about kind of what happens at the end of this system when somebody who's been in foster care reaches the age of 18 and, as we call it, ages out and is kind of pushed out into the world to sink or swim on their own. I guess I want to start this part of the conversation talking about what happened to you. You went into foster care as a very young child. But your outcomes look different than most of the other people who have that experience.
I'm very lucky in that way, and I'm truly grateful. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that, I often say this, I went to public school. I went to the Los Angeles Unified School District at a time that it was a strong school district. When I went to school, I sat with teachers, and you know what? When I sat with them, when they taught me, when they just did their job, they had no idea I was a foster child. Hmm. And that was such a relief. I could just be a kid. And I had good teachers who cared. And so by the time I reached 12th grade, I just went ahead and on my own, I applied to 4 colleges, all more on the East Coast. My last meeting with the social worker was, "I don't think you should go to those colleges. I don't think you'll make it." Hmm. I went ahead and I applied anyway. Now, I didn't have any way of knowing how I was going to pay for this. I barely knew how I was going to get there. I worked at a local grocery store. I saved up my money, and I bought that plane ticket, and I landed in New York. And then I stepped on to the campus of the school that I went to for the first time, Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and they gave me a full scholarship. And that changed my life. And I will ever, ever be grateful for them.
So the social worker that was giving you advice, that was a school social worker, or was that someone in the foster care system?
That was my foster care social worker. That was what you'd call your caseworker. The person who is singularly responsible for what's happening in your life. Is this placement going well? Are you getting the things that you need?
Yeah. And what was your relationship like with that person? I mean, this was obviously not great advice they were giving you about college. What was the rest of that back and forth like at that critical age where you're about to, again, go out into the world?
Well, in that moment, I didn't know her. I'd had dozens of social workers at that point. Mm. She was just another stranger coming to the house. And by that time, as a child, as a young teen or a teenager, my lesson was they come and you just manage these visits. You just get on through. You make it through. And so when she sat and looked at me and said, all those plans that you have, those possibilities of scholarships and financial aid and all the things you're hoping on, don't do it. I smiled because there was that sense, and we mentioned this earlier, that sense that this system wasn't fundamentally on my side, that I was on my own. And that's when I talk to kids today and you ask them, what do you feel like when you're 18 and you spent all that time in foster care? What they say are things like, I was on my own. I raised myself.
So let's go back again to this moment where you're picked up by the police as a young boy and taken from your mother. Walk us through what the next 10 or 12 years look like. Where do you go? Where are you living? And who is taking care of you until you get to this point where you're applying to college on your own?
Sure. The first place that I was taken was a place called McLaren Hall. McLaren's a pretty infamous place now. There are literally thousands of lawsuits that have been brought against McLaren for the abuse of children there.
And this is in McLaren Los Angeles?
It's in Los Angeles, yes. Correct. McLaren was run directly by the County of Los Angeles. What McLaren was an abandoned polio hospital filled with wards and hallways and basements. And on arrival, I was stripped. I was handed a McLaren uniform, told to surrender everything that I had. And I will always remember that first night so well. And the truth is when you ask foster children, what was that first day like? They will describe it with incredible detail because it is the most traumatic day of their lives. What happened to me was after I was given my uniform, it's a very simple thing. I was 6 years old. I was very shy. Truth is, I'd only been naked in front of my mom. And when it came to gang shower, I just couldn't do it. And so what they did is they dragged me down to a basement and they kept me there.
Down,
and then they came and they got me back.
Down to a basement.
Down to a basement in an abandoned polio hospital. After that, well, I took showers, but I don't forget it. And I ended up spending a year there. I tried to run away once. If you look at my wrist, there's a thin line along the side of my wrist, very razor line. Mm-hmm. And what it's from was after being at McLaren for, I'm not even sure, 6-8 months, something like that, I decided I was going to try to run back to mom. Mm. Now here's a 7-year-old deciding he's going to try to do that. But I climb up this fence, this 13-foot high fence wrapped with barbed wire. I get to the top, and right as I'm at the top, one of the orderlies reaches, grabs my legs, and my wrist gets caught on that wire.
Oh.
And every time I look at that, when I'm sitting with a kid, that's important because it reminds me of what they may be feeling. That sense of isolation, that desire to go home.
Yeah. So after McLaren, where do you
After go? McLaren, I was after McLaren, I was placed in a foster home. Originally, it was a temporary home. Social worker promised to come back and get me. She said, I'll be back in 3 weeks. She never did. She never came back. And so I stayed with that one foster family, which was a good thing. It meant that I went to the same schools. It meant that I had some sense of stability. Hmm. But the truth of it was, that foster family was not a good foster family. I spent all of my teenage years being threatened to be sent back to that institution.
By the family?
By the family. And so that was that sense of instability, that sense of loss of where am I going to go? And I saw kids come and go. Other kids came and went. Some kids ran away. Some kids came and went over a day. And I saw them from infants. That's how I learned to change diapers. all the way up to 17, close to 18-year-old kids, and that sense of loss that they felt. And that's why I do what I do today, mm-hmm. and why I've written the books that I've written, and why those things are important, because I feel that for them. And it's an honor to do it with them.
Yeah. You spoke a little earlier about money being an incentive in the foster system, and maybe even more than that, maybe that money drives the system. The experience with your foster family kind of suggests a little piece, I suppose, of what that looks like.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why they kept me. I don't know why they felt it necessary to do sort of the things that they did, some of the crazy things they did. But I'm fairly confident saying the money that they got didn't hurt. And that's the thing. I don't think that most foster parents actually do it for money. I don't think there's enough money to do it. I think there are other places that do it for money. I think congregate care facilities, big group homes, those are the sorts of facilities that we look at. And we're talking about not $4,000 to $5,000 a month. We're talking about $50,000 a month and up, mm-hmm. to keep a child in one of those facilities. And that's when we're talking about money.
Yeah, yeah. You're advocating, of course, for children now. Is what you're advocating for, I guess, more stability? In some ways, you had some stability in the strictest definition of the word. You were with one foster family for a long period of time. But even hearing you describe it suggests to me the sense of instability that you had, maybe because of the things that the family was telling you would happen or using to control your behavior. But I guess, is stability the thing that is missing fundamentally from the equation here in the foster system?
I think stability is missing, and also the fact that kids enter foster care and they don't need to be taken. Hmm. When you're looking at a system that takes 70% of its kids from their family because of neglect, mm-hmm. which really most often just means poverty, that's not the way to handle poverty. It's expensive. It's traumatic. It doesn't work. I could have been placed back with my grandmother. Was my grandmother rich? No. My grandmother worked as a junior assistant for an oil company in Chicago. Mm. She was poor. She hadn't gone to college, hadn't graduated from high school, but she could have cared for me. And had they decided to make that decision, I would have lived with my family. And so when I talk to kids and sit with kids, it's stability. But what stability means to those children is what it means to every child. When they think of stability, what's the first thing they think of?
Family.
They think of mom and dad.
Yeah.
They think of their parents. They think of their family. That is what stability is. And that's what foster care takes from children too often.
Yeah, yeah. When you are advocating for kids now and they talk to you about this kind of stability, what do you hear from defenders of the foster care system about that stability? They probably would say, I'm guessing, well, we're providing that, right? We're getting them into homes. We're getting them with families. What do they say when you say that's not the kind of stability that kids need?
Well, here's the thing. I've worked for foster care departments. I've actually been an employee of foster care departments. I've mm-hmm. sued them. I've been in every sort of place on that table that you can be, and they still talk to me. So what it is the, when you talk to heads of big departments, heads of LA foster care, heads of Chicago foster care, heads of New York foster care, they don't actually defend the system. They will talk about, we are taking too many kids in and we're keeping them too long, mm-hmm. and that has to stop. And so there aren't very many people that actually say, this system is working. It's great. I've never gone to a conference. I've never met with a social worker who said, I love the way foster care is working. It's doing great.
Yeah.
Because they know it isn't. And we've known that for decades. And so I think it's this ability to really take a look at how we're going to change that.
Yeah, I was going
to
say,
and where it's, Yeah.
What becomes the obstacle then if everybody?
What's the goal? How do we get to that finish line that we really want to get to? And that finish line is to respect families, to sit down with a family in poverty and say, you know what? We're going to go ahead and we're going to find childcare for you. You know what? We're going to help you with your rent. You know, we're going to have an in-home aid. And those things may sound complicated, but at the end of the day, just on money, just on the costs, you'll save money that way. You'll save money providing that to families. And also, you won't traumatize them. You won't traumatize kids. And you won't put them in a system where we know the results.
Yeah.
We know that fewer than 3% are ever going to graduate from college.
Yeah.
We know that a quarter of them are going to be instantly homeless at the age of 18. And so we ought to look at that and say, how can we fix this? And the way we fix this is every child belongs to a family. And they belong to the family where they came from most often.
Yeah. I want to talk about the consequences for the children and for you specifically. You know, you figured it out and got to a place that not only most other foster children might not have gotten to, but I mean, almost any person would like to have achieved the things that you achieved. At the same time, I imagine that there are still consequences that you live with and try to manage. I'm curious about what those look like for you and what they look like for other children.
Well, I appreciate that question. You know, when I introduced and people introduced me as a graduate of Harvard Law School or a Fulbright scholar, first of all, it's a little embarrassing to hear, and I was sort of blush at people saying that about me. But here's the thing. Yeah, I am so grateful for those things. And those things are just wonderful. They brought me things. I've gone places that I never would have gone. But you know, Harvard Law School, it doesn't take away night terrors.
Mm.
It doesn't take away bouts of anxiousness. It doesn't take away that sense. And this is what children talk about, that sense that something's going to happen. You know, I once saw a boy who gave a speech at a big gala in Los Angeles. And he was just a heck of a kid. He got up and he graduated from Stanford. And he went around and people finally gave this beautiful speech. And then the lights went on and people were asking questions. And the last question that he was asked, he said, what was the thing you took away from foster care? What did you learn? And the boy paused. And as I watched him, he said, it's the loneliness. The loneliness won't go away.
Wow.
And so most often when I talk to young adults, when I talk to a 23-year-old, frankly, when I talk to a 50-year-old and I say, what's the legacy of foster care? The legacy of what happened to you? They'll talk about that, that loneliness, that sense that something is going to happen, that the world is not a stable place. And for me, I was able to manage that, but I shouldn't have had to manage that. And certainly when I look at other kids, they shouldn't have to manage it. And so when I come at the end of the day, I look at these kids and these young adults and I think, you know, these are some of the bravest. These are the bravest people that I know. They walk around this around the world with this inside them every day and they still do their very best.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to take another quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Andrew Bridge about the foster care system. Stay where you are. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. Welcome back to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm glad you've joined us. We're talking today to Andrew Bridge, who is a children's rights lawyer and a survivor of the American foster system. He has a new book forthcoming titled The Child Catcher. Andrew, I want to talk a little about who's disproportionately affected, I guess, by some of these problems, as we see in many other in many other realms with many other things. There are some communities that experience more of this issue than others. I don't know that anyone will be surprised to hear which ones, but I'd love to have you talk about it.
I want to thank you for asking that question because it's a really important one, and it's one we've known the answer to for decades. Black families are overwhelmingly impacted by this system.
Mm-hmm.
And all the way from the very beginning, the way you start in a foster care system is someone makes a call. They say, something doesn't seem right with my neighbor. Teacher makes a call. Something doesn't seem right with this kid. Doctor makes a call from an emergency room. I'm a little concerned about this. What we see, though, is that disproportionately, people call these teachers, physicians, they call foster care departments overwhelmingly on Black children,
on black
families.
Yeah.
So to use the example of a medical professional, if you look at kids who go to emergency rooms, Black families go to emergency room and typically their child actually has fewer injuries. Their child is not hurt as much as a white child.
Hmm.
Just a fact. Stanford University did a wonderful study on this. But what happens once that family steps into that emergency room is a very different experience from what happens when a white family does. What will happen to their child is their child will receive more scans. Their child will stay longer. And at the end of the day, they are far more likely to have that physician call the foster care department and say, you need to investigate them. And so it's those sort of things that produce the result that we've known.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Black child in this family, in this country, by the time that you reach age 18, if you're a Black child in this family, by the time you're age 18, you are 50% likely, half, to have had your local foster care department knock on your door and investigate your family.
Mm.
You are twice as likely to be investigated over a white family. And I just want folks to imagine this for a moment.
Sure.
Imagine someone knocking on your door, you don't know who they are, and they say, I'm here to investigate how you're treating your children. It's terrifying.
And,
it's absolutely terrifying.
You know, I mean, you know, as an African American, again, I'm not surprised by that stat. And I think it's reflective of the biases and institutional racism that exists in our country more broadly, right? If I walk into a bank and ask for a loan, the fact that I'm an African American means that the chances of me getting that loan are really different.
Absolutely.
A white person. If I'm driving my car, the chances of me being pulled over by the police. I mean, these are the things that we learn to live with. But here it seems to me that there is something even more pernicious about, again, the consequence and the outcome. The idea of losing your child in part because of this bias. I mean, it's unimaginable.
You lose the thing that's most important to you in your life. Right, we all know that as parents, or you face that potential loss. And so what families feel when you talk to them, you say, how do you feel as a Black family living in a community that's facing this? What they feel is they feel like they're under surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They feel fear. They feel that this department is going to come and investigate me. And you know what? I don't have the authority. I don't have the authority of a better off white family to say, no, you cannot enter my home. That's not allowed. You don't have a warrant to enter my home, something that they are actually supposed to have unless there's imminent harm. I don't have to answer these questions. And so what you see is that sense of vulnerability. And once there, that sense of, I'm now on the radar, I'm now more likely to be investigated again. And it's true, you are. And then once that child enters foster care, a Black child is less likely to go home, more likely to spend far more time in foster care, less likely to be adopted. And at every single point along that line, when we make a decision that's of importance to that Black child, they will do worse than a white child.
Yeah.
They are less likely to receive educational supports. They're more likely to put into congregate care rather than an individual foster home. They're less likely to be given jobs. They're less likely to receive mental health care than white children. And when you look at the long-term results, when they leave, they face far worse results. And so to go to your example of driving your car, entering a store, the things that Black folks feel in this country, well, our foster care system reflects that same racism. And that's what it is.
So let's talk about solutions. The central theme, I think, of your work here is children belong with their families, and the foster care system comes along and disrupts that truth, and disrupts it permanently. Is that where we start when we want to think about solutions?
I think that's exactly where we start. Yeah. And I think where we start is, you know what? We're not good at judging families, and maybe we shouldn't. I'll give you an example. When I worked in Alabama, I went to it was a squatter's camp. And in this squatter's camp, it was crowded with adults, right? And this was a place where the only cash they got was you know, local assistance, which they then pooled, and they'd use it to buy things that they couldn't grow. And as I was walking through this camp, there was a boy. And surrounded by adults, surrounded by community, had his parents. And I looked at a friend of mine who actually worked for the ACLU, and I said, if you were the foster care department, would you take that boy? Would you remove him? Mm-hmm. And without a moment's hesitation, he looked at me and he said, no, because this is where he belongs. These are his people. These are the people that know him. These are the people that will produce that sense of love inside of him, that sense of stability that he's going to need.
And I guess to push back a little and play devil's advocate in the other way, why shouldn't the state have an interest in doing better than what that child might be doing? Or in starting the conversation from the standpoint of, can we do better? Do we have an obligation to do better? When we see something that could be fixed or could be changed.
We have an obligation to do better, and we can do better. It's just doing better doesn't mean taking a child from their family because they're poor or because they're struggling. What it means is helping that family in the best way we possibly can. Helping that family find a job, helping that family find an apartment, helping that family with childcare. All of those things mean keeping that family together and avoiding the outcomes that we know we're getting in the child welfare system. We know this, we can do better, it's within our grasp. It is so close to do, but it starts with that core premise, that core idea of this family is worth saving. I respect this family. I respect this mom and dad. They may not live in circumstances that I would want to live in. Mm-hmm. They may not live in circumstances that I think are great for a child, but you know what? I respect them. And I respect their integrity.
Yeah.
And that's what families feel they lack. When you talk to Black families, for example, the last word that they're going to use is, the department treated me with integrity. Mm. And that's what we need. We owe them that.
So earlier you were talking about the fact that you believe that money is one of the reasons that we have a hard time making these changes, that we have a hard time kind of either ignoring the money or sidelining that issue in favor of these other things. What are some of the other obstacles to, again, changing that prioritization of assessment, saying, look, we want to focus on keeping people with their families whenever possible?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we need to look and realize that a department, that an entity that has the capacity to take your children is not going to be a very good department or a very good entity that's there for families.
Mm-hmm.
Because families know that if you, this department, at any time have the capacity to take me from my children, take my children from me. So I'll give you an example. Very often what will happen is a mom will be required to go to counseling. Now, we want that counseling to go well,
mm-hmm.
right? We want her to be honest with her counselor. We want her to genuinely be helped, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we want. That's the whole point. When we go to counseling, that's what we want. But because of this system, the way it operates, everything that mom says that's in confidence to her counselor is turned over to the department
mm-hmm.
and potentially used against her. And it's that rub that idea that, you know what, this needs to be something separate. This, we need to have departments and assistants for families that do not involve taking kids from their parents.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Andrew Bridge, it has been really great to have this conversation with you. I want to talk a little about in your forthcoming book, what's the sort of new there? What are we going to learn from the Child Catcher when it comes out?
Thank you so much. The Child Catcher is actually the place where my first book, Hope's Boy, started and ended. It started with me finding a boy in a basement in an isolated facility in Alabama. Mm-hmm. And Hope's Boy ended with me going back to that boy. What The Child Catcher is about is my very first lawsuit as a civil rights lawyer representing children. And it's a true story. It's about meeting kids, finding parents who try desperately to get mental health assistance for their kids, mm-hmm. and put them voluntarily into a state-run institution and wasn't able to get them the help they need. Now, it's really, the real hero of this story isn't me. The real hero of this story is a 13-year-old boy that I worked with, a 13-year-old boy who testified against the state of Alabama. He was the first boy that I had on a stand. I remember I put him in an Alabama courtroom, put him on a witness stand. Boy, it was 70 pounds. He could barely see over the wall. And that boy went ahead and he testified against the state of Alabama and said what was happening to kids and families who got involved with the system. The state of Alabama opposed closing this facility, went all the way to federal court. It was a tough battle. And ultimately, it was a battle about what we see today. It's a battle about families trying to find help for their kids. It's about the right of families to go ahead and have the last word on what happens to their kids. And it's about what happens to kids today who have emotional issues, who have mental health issues, and where they end up.
Yeah.
There's something called the troubled teen industry, which are these multi-state private corporations that run institutions where children end up. They make a lot of money.
Yeah.
And if you go through headlines, you see tremendous abuse that's going on within these facilities. You see that these facilities actually are not serving children, that these facilities are really largely, not all of them, but often about profit.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
I mean, it's almost as if to make the change that we need, we need to have the voice of these families represented in some way. I wonder if that needs to be done outside of the foster care system. In other words, is the system so invested in itself and in these outcomes that you need something from the outside that says, here is the interest of these families, and that's got to be taken seriously alongside these other things.
Exactly right. And that's why the book's called The Child Catcher, because if you ask parents how they feel once their child gets into this system, they feel that they've been caught.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They feel that an entity has taken their child and they can't get them back. And the truth is, in The Child Catcher, what happened is when families went ahead and had their kids admitted to this facility and they decided they want them back, the state wouldn't give them back.
Wow.
They actually would go ahead and say, you know what? While your child was here, your child committed an offense. Child hit another child. Your child got in a fight. You know what? That's a crime. So I'm going to give you a choice. You can go ahead and you put your child back in this facility, or I will arrest your child and your child will go into juvenile justice.
Yeah.
And that's what the federal court found. The federal court actually described this place as a children's prison.
Wow.
And this is one of those places that we need to remember, and we can stand up against them. And that's what it was. It was my first effort. What I will say is, it was very gratifying as a lawyer. Personally, it was kind of tough because when I stepped into that facility wrapped with fencing and barbed wire, the first thing that came to mind was, this was like the place that I was first placed in as a little boy. This was like the polio hospital that was McLaren Hall and that Los Angeles kept me in for a year.
Wow.
And so looking at those orderlies, yeah, I could keep my lawyerly face on, my fresh out of law school lawyerly face. But inside of me, it was tough.
Okay. Andrew Bridge, really great to have you here with us on Created Equal. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed this.
That's it for Created Equal. You can listen to recent episodes at WDET.org and make sure to subscribe to our podcast, where you can leave us a rating or a review. Created Equal is produced by Carrie Jr. II and David Lines. The audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University.